Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we've got a dynamic hour for you. And I want you to have a pad of paper and a pen handy. That's almost mandatory with the Donna Sebo Show, because you know you're going to hear something within the program that you're going to want to make a note about. And that's not going to be any less today than any other day. We have a wonderful guest. We're talking with Irvin Laszlo, and he is in Tuscany, Italy. Remember, BBS Radio, we reach around the world, and we have people as our guests from around the world, and it's not any exception today. And Mr. Laszlo's book is The Chaos Point, The World at the Crossroads. Irwin, may I call you Irwin?
Yes, absolutely, Donna. Please do.
Oh, thank you so much. Now, Irwin, your book really intrigued me, because not only are you a world traveler and a very accomplished man on so many levels, but I want to share with my audience that you are the founder and president of the Club of Budapest. You co-chair the World Wisdom Counselor. You are the chancellor of the World University, which is an online educational institution of the Club of Budapest and the Rye Foundation. You're the founder and director of the General Evolution Research Group, the president of the Private University for Economics and Ethics of Vienna. You're a fellow of the World Academy of the Arts and Sciences, member of the International Academy of Philosophy of Science. You're a senator of the International Medici Academy and editor of the international periodical World Futures, the Journal of General Evolution. You are also the author or co-author of 47 books that have been translated into as many as 20 languages, and you're the editor of another 30 volumes, including a 4-volume encyclopedia. My goodness, do you ever sleep?
Well, sometimes. But when I'm awake, I try to get things done.
Well, there is so much. Your life is just so full. You have so much going on. You have you've been the recipient of 4 honorary PhDs. You received the Peace Prize of Japan, the Goya Award of in Tokyo in 2002, the International Mandela Peace Prize in Assisi in 2005, and you were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004, and you were re-nominated in 2005. You live at this time, as much as you possibly can with your very busy schedule, in Tuscany, Italy. And I know when you open up your information about your book that there's a very profound gentleman that I have a tremendous amount of respect for, and that's Sir Arthur Clarke, who's one of the leading writers of science fiction, but he's a scientist as well. He's recognized throughout the world for much of his vision. And your Club of Budapest, how did all of this evolve? I mean, here you are, still involved in so many other areas and with organizations. How did the Club of Budapest come together?
Well, it kind of happened. Actually, the story of its happening is the story of one night, which was the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Club of Rome, which was, you know, if some of your listeners may or may not recall, it was way back in 72, there was published a book that was reported on very widely in all the media. It is called The Limits to Growth. And that was published by a think tank, which was made up of 100 people, and I was one of the founders of that. And we have, and that think tank was made up of business people and political leaders and scientists, and we have thought of calling attention to problems that need to be solved ahead of time. And the 10th anniversary of that meeting took place in Rome, and after there were some major politicians there. At the time, the Prime Minister of Italy was there, and a number of other dignitaries from various parts of the world. And I was talking with the president of the Club of Rome, who was one of the executives of Fiat, the automobile company.
Mm-hmm.
And we said that, well, now we again call attention to problems that need to be faced, and do you think something will happen? And of course, everybody said at the meeting how wonderful, and this is why, you know, we must anticipate things, and we must start acting more cautiously and see what kind of growth is possible, not every kind is. And then we thought, well, but of course nothing like this is going to really happen because people are going to go back to their jobs Monday morning and then they do more or less what they have been doing before. And there's a lot of inertia.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we do? And the idea that came up on a late midnight walk in Rome at the time was how can we reach sort of the heart of people, not only just the mind of some leadership groups who can only act after all when they have supporters and followers, but how can we reach people? And the thought came up that we should try to involve artists and writers and people, spiritual people, and people in medicine, and particularly in alternative medicine and healing. So these were the thoughts that we had. And at the time, Mr. Pecei, as I said, was the executive of Fiat, was the vice president, said to me, why don't I try to bring together such a club? In view of the fact that, you know, I had a lot of contact among the world of artists because I started my career actually as a concert pianist. I was in music.
Mm-hmm.
So then the idea came up, let's have a club of writers and artists. And this club wasn't born until quite some time because this was in 78, this conversation, and the club was only born in 93. Because until then, I tried talking about this, but and everybody thought it's a fine idea, but nobody came forth to try to actually sponsor it until a day came about in the summer of 93, which happened to be in Budapest at a conference where I was invited to give a keynote talk. I was living in New York at the time, and I came over there because a lot of Hungarians from the West were there. And it was an international meeting of Hungarians, not just of Hungary, but from all over the world. And since I was born in Budapest, I was invited, and I gave the keynote talk, and I suggested that we should have an artists and writers club formed right in Hungary. And I thought, well, nothing much is going to happen on this, like suggested before in other places too. But next morning I got a call from the prime minister, who apparently was in the audience, I didn't know, and he said, could I meet with me? And I came over, and he said, well, would you like to set up this club over here? I said, wonderful, Mr. Prime Minister, if you help me to do it. And they made the arrangement, which are actually working to this very day, where we got office space and we got the secretariat set up so that we could start creating a think tank devoted to ideas that people can really grasp, that can reach people. You know, so that was the beginning of the Club of Budapest, because the idea was then, well, as long as it's formed here in Budapest, the Club of Rome was formed in Rome, let's call it Budapest, okay? As long as we know that it's not limited to just the city or even to the country of Hungary or even to Europe, but it's a worldwide organization. And the Prime Minister agreed, and that's the Club of Rome, how it was born in December of 93.
The club is dedicated to some very important things. And I'm going to read it directly from your book. You're dedicated to the evolution of values, ethics, and consciousness in the interest of averting a global crisis in creating a peaceful and sustainable civilization. You have so many people that have opted to become a part of this. Mikhail Gorbachev, Bianca Jagger, Edgar Mitchell, who's a scientist astronaut, Asa C. Clarke, who is a visionary, the 14th Dalai Lama, Milos Forman, who is a film director, Jane Goodall, who is a scientist and activist, and the list goes on and on. People from many different areas of industry, science, and backgrounds. And when I first got your book, and I saw the title, The Chaos Point, The World at the Crossroads. And then you had the subtitle, 7 Years to Avoid Global Collapse and Promote Worldwide Renewal. And I can remember thinking, this is very interesting that you are right there on the cover of the book, which is beautifully illustrated, by the way, on the cover. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this is interesting that you're making a 7-year projection. Tell us, you've broken down in the book, chaos, a chaos window, and a chaos point. What are the differences?
Well, a chaos window is a time when one can introduce changes. You know, I use chaos in the sense in which it's used in the sciences, in chaos theory, which doesn't mean a complete absence of order. It doesn't mean something that's completely, as we popularly say, that's just chaotic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It, in a chaotic system is a very finely structured system that's very, very sensitive. You know, the story about the butterfly effect, you know, that's,
yes.
that's the illustration of chaos. If there is a butterfly in California flapping its wings, it creates a tiny little air current that can, in the very sensitive weather system, it can just amplify and amplify until it changes the weather pattern in Mongolia next year, next
mm-hmm.
week. You know, so a chaotic system is a very highly sensitive system that even small effects can make major impacts on. So a chaos window is a time when this system is entering a phase in which even small effects can have big causes can have big effects. And I think we are in such a window now when people thinking changes in lifestyles, changes in consumer patterns, changing in people's political preferences, the way they look at their own responsibility in the community, all of these things can have a major impact. We are not in a very stable system. This system is already the whole world system. It's become economic system, the social and political system is very unstable, as you well know. So this is the chaos window. Now, the chaos point is what is popularly known as the tipping point. The tipping point is when you reach a point in time when things must change because you simply can't stand still anymore. You can't hold the system. This is when the popular expression is the last straw, which really the basis of that is you can load the back of a camel more and more and more until you add just one more straw and the back of the camel breaks. So in a chaos point, something sudden happens because it reaches that point when the system becomes critically unstable. And we know this in the chaos theory because it can be simulated on the computer, and all of a sudden you find up till now you introduce changes and then you have small change, small effects. All of a sudden you make one more change and the whole system changes, you know, and the entire thing either breaks down or becomes something else. And I think that's the point that we are going to reach, according to my estimation, by around the end of 2012.
Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote the foreword in your book, his very first sentence in that foreword is, "Anyone who attempts to write about the future should take warning from all the failures of the past." He says, "The future is not to be forecast, but created. What we do today will decide the shape of things tomorrow. And of the many things that are possible, not all are desirable." And he said, "We science fiction writers don't predict the future. We try to prevent undesirable futures taking place." Now, this is a man who is a scientist as well, has a tremendous curiosity. He's in his 90s, and he is just phenomenal with what he chooses to continue to be a part of. His expression through his writings is just absolutely phenomenal, and he goes in to talk about the revolutionary new power sources that he feels that are going to be coming available. Hopefully it won't be as long as 50 years, which is one of his projections. But he said there's so much that we need to be aware of that we must catch up with the world our technological genius has created, update the way we perceive it, the way we value it, and the way we act in it. And you would call this a macro shift.
Yes. Yes, I mean, a macro shift is the kind of change that happens at the chaos point. It is a change which occurs all over, through the entire system, on the political level, economic level, the ecological level, and the social and cultural level as well. Just about every aspect of life is changing in a macro shift. That's macro. And so it's not a specialized change. And that's when the system reaches that point where it is no longer, to use the most popular word today, which I think we have to need to recall, it's sustainable. And the world is no longer sustainable the way it has been operating. Then I think we reach the chaos point, and that's a macro shift.
Now, you said we have two paths to the future, and trends are not destiny. Explain the two paths to the future.
Well, when you are now at a decision window, I think between now for the next 7 years, or 6.5 to 7 years, roughly, we are living at a time when we can introduce changes that will really create widely different futures when the point comes when the system is obliged to change. Because, as you know, nothing really changes until it's forced to change. People like to stay put, like to keep doing the same kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of conservatism, a lot of habit-forming patterns in people and in society. But when change has to happen, then, of course, it happens. And then it can happen very fast. It's what is known in the science as this abrupt change. And this abrupt change will come about, and it can basically create a world which either then collapses and becomes chaotic in an ordinary sense of the word, when there is no order, and there could be a lot of violence, a lot of breakdown, and revolution, and upheaval, and nobody quite knows then what would happen. Or it could break through to a system which is much more sustainable, which is simply a system that's able to operate and to bring a level of well-being to all people that is acceptable, that where people can live and can work with each other, can get along. So I think that's the critical point. There are two scenarios, two ultimate scenarios. This system, beyond the chaos point, which I think, as I said, we reached by the end of 2012, we either break down and move toward a Holocaust kind of a situation, which I hope not, and actually I firmly believe that that is not going to happen, but there's a real possibility that it could. Or we can move toward a new world, which is essentially a new kind of a civilization, a global level of civilization, which has a lot of diversity, not everybody the same, not all societies are the same, but we are all agreed that we are members of the crew of a spaceship, and we must live in a way that the whole crew can survive, and the spaceship itself, which is the Earth, is in a good working condition. So that is the critical issue. Can we create such a world? I think we can, and we have to change. So I think our best choice is to create a sustainable and a peaceful world, and it is now the time, in the next 6 to 7 years, to prepare for this.
You make a number of very interesting comments in your book. One is that 87 countries today neither produce sufficient food to sustain their population nor have the money to import the missing amount from outside of their country. Also, that the economies in the U.S., China, and a few other Asian economies are not sustainable. I'll pick up on the word that you used. And you make a couple of other points. And for those of you who have just tuned in to the broadcast, we're talking with Ervin Laszlo. His book is The Chaos Point, The World at the Crossroads. It's fascinating reading, and it is not a negative book. It is an informative book. It is meant to make you think and to realize that you can be a part of the solution. You can be a part of the problem, or you can be part of the solution. And we are discussing this with him. We're talking with him. He's in Tuscany, Italy, where it is midnight, and we're very grateful that he's been able to stay up and be with us. And you bring up the point the U.S. consumes too much and exports too little, while China and other Asian countries consume too little and export too much. You bring out a number of points, and you have the three C's relative to extensive growth, which in your view is conquest, colonization, and consumption, and then in intensive growth, it is connection, communication, and consciousness. Why do you differentiate between the two?
Well, one is non-sustainable and the other one is. I mean, that one leads to a breakdown, the other one leads to a breakthrough of a situation. If we put as a highest value the conquest and consumption, then we will eventually create a polarized world where the small minority gets rich and richer and richer, which is already happening, and gets more and more powerful, but it's not able to use its power because wherever it tries to use its power, it's just creating havoc. And the great majority is being pushed into a marginal situation, and it's just prone to conflict. And this is has been happening all along history when the powerful have been trying to conquer the less powerful. And if you continue doing this on a small spaceship, the planet Earth, then this is going to feed back on us because there's no longer any place to go. I mean, we can't just sort of conquer more and more territories. We now live in almost all habitable parts of the globe. And we are in communication with each other because we have worldwide communication systems.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't anymore think that it's all right to behave in a selfish way, which will just marginalize others, and we are just going to conquer everything, because this is feeding back to us in terms of conflict and war and terror and ecological disaster and economic and financial problems and all the rest. So I think we have got to communicate, we have got to try to create connections with each other, we've got to become conscious of the issues. And so I think that's the positive road. So the two C's that lead on the negative side to a breakdown, and the other C's on communication and contact and consciousness. And these are leading to a world that could be peaceful and sustainable.
You have so many people that are a part of the Club of Budapest, and you have more, I know, that are joining every day because they, like you and those that are with you, feel like they want to be a part of something that is going to make this world a better place. And they do it in their own daily lives, but they feel like they want to come together as a team with the Club of Budapest to make even more of an impact. How do you see the future? Because you have a strong belief in it. You're not a doomsday type of person. You're not afraid to look at the negative things that have to be looked at. You have, though, a very optimistic outlook. What is the world you view of 2025?
Well, as we said at the very beginning, as Arthur Clarke said in the foreword to this book also, the future is not to be forecast, but to be created. And I fully agree with that, and they say that it's always an if-then proposition. 2025 could be a peaceful, sustainable world of 8 billion people, roughly, who each have sufficient food and shelter and opportunity for gainful employment and be able to have sufficient level of freedom to pursue happiness their own way. And it's all possible. We have the technology, we have the energy, there's an enormous amount of solar radiation, solar energy reaching us. We could use much more of that than we are using. We're using a tiny fraction only. We have the know-how. It is entirely possible. But it is also possible that we continue in a short-sighted way, the way that leads to more and more conflict and confrontation and violence. And in that case, 2025 would be a world in which a small part of existing humanity will be able to survive in a very depleted planet and living under relatively miserable conditions. And there's, God knows if there will be any kind of a law and order in that world. That's, of course, the absolute doomsday scenario. As I say, it's possible. I don't believe it will happen, but it's possible. So you can't say what it will be. You can only say what it would be if, you know.
In November 2003, there was a group of Nobel Peace laureates that met in Rome, and they affirmed this, and I'm quoting from your book, "Ethics in the relations between nations and in government policies is of paramount importance. Nations must treat other nations as they wish to be treated. The most powerful nations must remember that as they do, so shall others do." And in November 2004, this same group declared, "Only by reaffirming our shared ethical values, respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, and by observing democratic principles within and amongst countries, can terrorism be defeated. We must address the root causes of terrorism, which is poverty, ignorance, and injustice." And I'll think I'll add my own special word, superstition, rather than responding to violence with violence. when you have the human equation, Irvin, there will be those individuals. I've shared your book with various people, and they say the human equation is so very much consistent in what it's done throughout history. Will there be enough to be able to counteract the actions of a few that cannot see how destructiveness is not the right way to go, but to build, to work with our nature, our environment, our earth, and with each other in a way that allows us to be, as you have described? What would you say to that challenge where they don't believe that it's a possibility because of what's happened in past history?
Well, it depends on how you look at history. History is not only the story of dictators and bloodshed and violence. History is also the story of people cooperating and creating civilizations, creating cities, creating empires, creating ways in which they work together. We are not living in the jungle, after all. We have a history of civilization. What is different today is that civilization we have created is now planet-wide, it's worldwide. So we can't anymore have civilizations that are opposed to one another and being intolerant of one another. We must create a global level world, a global level culture. So here there is one or other major rule, which actually I haven't mentioned in my book, but I've been thinking about more and more lately, and that's a very simple rule coming from ecology, you know, the way nature operates.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an ecosystem, in other words, a lot of different species sharing the same environment, when there is a so-called immature ecosystem, when they're not full yet, not everything is exploited yet, there is still space to move around, there is a lot of violence, then the powerful can dominate the rest. When that system fills up to the point where they're using almost all the resources and all the space, then obviously this can't happen anymore because there simply won't be enough to go around, and one thing will lead to another, and it will lead to negative effects to everyone concerned. So at that point, the so-called mature ecosystems, they are becoming collaborative, cooperative, and then you see the species cooperating. Of course, there is still the chain, a food chain, whereby one species has to have for its food members of the other species. That's normal in nature. But there is no violence beyond that. And what is happening is that the overall system is maintained in a very harmonious and orderly way. And I think we are now reaching the point on Earth where we are reaching a maturity of some kind. And the maturity has to live up to it, of course. We are adolescents on the threshold of maturity. And this system that we are creating is now doesn't leave room anymore to have this kind of a selfish, short-sighted behavior, because it impacts back on us. Whoever does something to its neighbor that he doesn't wish to have done to himself eventually will get it back, you know, the negative thing. This is, by the way, the golden rule, and it's practiced in all the religions of the world. In one way or another, in Christianity it said, you know, don't do to others what you don't want others to do unto you. And this happens, you find this everywhere. And it is very true. When you live in a world which is highly interacting, highly using up its resources, living on its very edge, perhaps, of its viability, then I think you must be very careful to treat others as you would want to be treated and have respect for others. And that becomes ethics. That becomes the simple, minimal ethics, which says live in a way that permits others to live as well. Because if you don't let others to live, then sooner or later they'll come to strike back at you and they won't let you live.
Irvin Laszlo has been my guest today. His wonderful book is The Chaos Point, The World at the Crossroads. I would invite you to get his book and to read it, because it will cause you to examine perhaps some thoughts or attitudes or perceptions you've had. Not good, bad, or indifferent, but give you some insights into the way so many world leaders today who are part of the Club of Budapest are making a difference. Irwin, what is your website quickly? We're almost out of time here.
Well, it's Club of Budapest in one word, .org.
Club of Budapest?
Club of Budapest, .org.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being my guest. I so appreciate your staying up into midnight in Italy. And I know Tuscany is absolutely gorgeous. Enjoy your morning after you get a good rest.
Yes, I will. I enjoy talking with you very much.
Thank you so much, Erwin. Erwin Laszlo, Laszlo, the book, The Chaos Point. Thank you so much again for being my guest. This is Donna Siebel. We are taking a break. Don't you go away. We've got lots of good things to share with you. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Donna Siebel. For those of you that didn't get the website regarding Erwin Laszlo, and that's Laszlo, I want to repeat the name of his book, The Chaos Point, The World at the Crossroads. You can go in and find out about this very prestigious global organization at www.clubofbudapest, and that's BUDAPEST.org. This is significant. I feel when you have people from all over the world that are saying we can see in our respective environments how important it is to look at the modalities we have adopted and be initiators of education and understanding. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do here at bbsradio.com. And it is so important. Share this with your friends, won't you? Tell them about the Donna Siebel Show on bbsradio.com. Go ahead and do that because it is so important. You make a difference. Please know that. Now, by the way, I know we've got a caller on the line, and for those of you that might want to call in and chat with me today, here are our telephone numbers. And I say telephone numbers because we've got a local number in the U.S., 877-876-5227. Write this down and keep it handy. 877-876-5227. Now, for Canada, we have a special number for those of you in Canada, 888-810-8322. That's 888-810-8322. And then if you're calling in from Europe, we've got a direct line for you at 530-876-9146. That's 530-876-9146. Let's go to our caller. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
E from Tacoma.
I'm sorry, dear. I couldn't hear your name.
E.
C?
E. Elaine.
Oh, Elaine. Okay. I'm sorry. My ears aren't working very well, apparently. Your voice is a little bit soft too, Elaine. Elaine, as I'm watching you, I think that you are going to need some very clear planning and organization to get you through these next 3 to 4 months. And the reason that I'm saying this to you is you have so much on your plate. It's like someone's put a smorgasbord of information, opportunities, problems, a little bit of chaos here, there, and everywhere, all on this little platter. They've sort of shrunk it down so it can all be mushed together. That's a Donna term, mushed. And you're going, I can't have this. And you're deciding to take things off of this platter, putting them on a sideboard, saying, I don't want this yet. I'll look at that later, but I want to focus on certain things. And that's what you're going to need to do. That is how you need to focus. It is so important. I can't tell you how important this is. And you may have some side roads of activities that may distract you temporarily. But if you have to make a plaque, if you have to have a cork board where you stick a great big sign on it that says, this is my focus. Boom, boom, boom. If you cannot do that, then you're going to find it takes you maybe a year to get things on track. But if you have something that visually is going to keep you focused, you're going to do phenomenally well, even if you get distracted a little bit. This year and next year, I want to describe as a cleanup year. And I'm seeing you sometimes just gritting your teeth and going, I don't know that I like this. I don't know that I like this, but I'm going to get through it. And you will. You have to be patient. A lot's going on around you. There's not any of this slow motion stuff, not as I'm perceiving it. I'm looking at some very fast moving activity. So you have to keep your focus. You cannot get distracted very much. Think of a jet pilot. When he's piloting a plane that's going hundreds of miles an hour, he has to focus and be disciplined. He can't be flip-flopping around up in the sky. It just isn't going to be very effective. Think of the Blue Angels. Precision. Practice, practice, practice. Total focus, total concentration, being in the present. That's what you must keep in the forefront of your mind. What's your question for me today?
Well, it kind of goes along with all you're telling me, because I'm designing a house to be built in Lakewood with an architect.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and so I wondered if you had any advice for those final plans or insight, anything that would kind of help me with the planning?
Well, I think what we've covered is very important.
So it applies to that.
Yes. Now, what I would say is to keep your focus in the right positioning, you have to put your emotions on the sideboard. You, and I'll use the same description, you must be very disciplined about this. And I would encourage you, if you have had anyone that has built their own home or someone that's really got a lot of experience with doing this, say, I want your feedback. What would you recommend that I do? And if you have an ally like that, then that really keeps you where you need to be. The most important thing is recognizing, number one, you're going to have some delays with this. There's going to be problems. There's going to be oddball situations that are going to come up. And I can almost guarantee you, by the time you're finished with this, you're going to say, never again. I will never do this again. But the truth is, you will enjoy the result, but there must be the focus. There really must be that concentration. And check your information. Check your facts. Make sure that stuff is done correctly and that you have good contracts and that you have those people that are reputable, that are trustworthy, that you can work with.
But what about for the planning for the house? Do you see anything I won't be happy with or I should add or change?
I think when it comes to the plans for the house, if you can make up a mock-up that'll allow you to look at it in a three-dimensional format.
Yeah, he said he'll do that.
Well, then that's good, because you need to see that. And then what you need to do is pretend like you're walking through the house and ask him if there's any other house that is with the same plan design. And if there is, you need to go and see that house to see if it is what you want. There are a couple of rooms in the house that you want to make sure that are basically soundproofed, so that you're not going to have sounds overlapping. You need to talk to, I think, some people that have built their own homes, look at the pluses and the minuses. Ask yourself what you can perceive your needs as being. For example, making sure that you have plenty of outlets and a good amount of electrical wiring, because you may find that you want to have an office in your home. I'm just giving you an example.
No, I do.
So you may have to have extra electrical capacity throughout the house. I would say look at worst-case scenarios, look at safety factors. And again, if you can talk with some people that are builders and then walk in and really go through some other places and ask yourself, what do I like? Just not is it pretty, but is it something that I would want to live with for a long time? Also, when it would come for resale value, would it be something that would be a plus? You know, when you're looking at it, how can you make this really appealing? I think this is a marvelous project for you to be in, because I think your imagination is going to be utilized and all kinds of other good things. So don't be in a hurry with this. Take your time. Do it right.
And what did you mean by keep my emotions on the sideline?
Well, often when we get involved with, let's say, a house, we personalize it a great deal instead of just looking at it as a house. And say, all right, I have to deal with the practical things here. We have to have adequate plumbing. Do I want to use solar panels? What kind of cost am I going to have? Am I going to want to have a solar water heater where I don't have to worry about XYZ dollars going out a month? Do I want hardwood flooring? If so, is it going to be anchored down so it doesn't squeak? In other words, it's being able to look at things with eyes that are clear, looking at what your dream house would be, but also recognizing that sometimes if you have certain spaces that are opening, sound may carry up and everybody hears everything that's being discussed down below, upstairs.
Oh, true.
Okay? So you may want to look at sound insulation in the walls. What you might want to do is ask friends, ask women, because the guys are not as concerned as the gals are. And talk to the gals and say, what do you absolutely hate about your house? I'm not talking about the clutter or the fact you're not able to vacuum every other day. I want to know, what don't you like about your house?
Okay.
And what do you like about your house? And there are things you may not have even considered, like a certain type of lighting in your kitchen. You know, there are certain lights, for example, in kitchens that are a pain to change. They're awful. So talk to people. Talk to women. See what they have to say.
Okay, that's great advice.
Oh, you're more than welcome, hon. I do have to tell you, we've got to take a break, though.
Okay, thank you.
You're so welcome, and be sure and tell your friends about the show.
I will. Thanks, Donna.
And so thanks so much for calling in, hon.
Okay,
this
bye.
Is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break in just a moment. And if you'd like to call in, remember, we have a new number for those of you in Canada, 888-810-8322, U.S. 877-876-5227, or direct dial in 530-876-9146. Now, don't you go away. We're coming right back. More good things to share. Give me a buzz if you want to chat. Hi, this is Donna Sebo. I think we've got a little bit of a technical problem here, but that's okay. Telephone lines are open. Give us a call if you would like to chat. I wanted to also let you know that with my email newsletter, I'm going to be giving information about where I'm going to be traveling to during this coming month of September and also in October. So my sites that I'm going to be looking to visiting are Anchorage and Fairbanks, Alaska, also New York City. So I will be available for private appointments while I'm in those locales, and I'm also available for private appointment via the telephone at any time. And you can always call my office for more information, 800-872-8852. Also, I just went through today adding more information about upcoming guests. And even though I will be on the road, you're not going to miss any of these wonderful, wonderful people that we are going to be bringing to your attention here on the Donna Sebo Show. So I want to invite you to visit bbsradio.com, go in and check out my broadcast schedule. Also, you can go to my website, which is delphiinternational.com. And I want to take a moment and I want to mention something to you. There's been a very significant nutritional product that has made a difference in my life and in the lives of some of my friends, within my family, and I would love to introduce it to you. They're called glyconutrients, and if you go into my website, DelphiInternational.com, go to the left side of the homepage, you'll see a little button that says glyconutrients. I'd love for you to stop by and visit. Tap that little button, read the information, and if you'd like to know more about this, hey, give me a call. I can tell you some wonderful stories. Nutrition is so important. It is what enables us to stay healthy. And there are so many factors about nutrition that we're expanding into new levels of knowledge that we didn't have 10, 15 years ago. We've got them today. And I would love to be able to share that with you. So if you want to, give me a call at my office, 800-872-8852. Go to my website first. Visit the glyconutrients page. Give me a call if you'd like to talk about it more. So I was just talking about traveling. So many of us are out and about. It's summertime. The kids are out of school. And we want to go to places that we've maybe been thinking about all year long, saying, oh, this is great. Before you know it, it's going to be time for the kids to be back in school, and we are just going to not have that time to play. Well, flying is one of the best ways, in my estimation. I absolutely love to fly. And jet lag is something that you can experience. I've had it a few times. And it all depends on where you're going and how your body system relates. But if you are experiencing a feeling of fatigue and can't sleep, you know, it doesn't have to ruin your trip your first few days. There is a sleep specialist, Ruben Nyman, and he is a very much a professional sleep advisor. He said if you want to shift your body clock 2 to 3 days before you leave on a trip, adjust your watch to your destination time, then start adjusting your habits to that time, including when you sleep and when you eat, and then your body will adapt very readily. Also, when you're on the plane, if you're on a flight that's taking you to Australia, maybe to Europe, walk up and down the aisles of the plane as much as you can. Stretch your back, your arm, your leg muscles, and you might even want to carry a little rubber ball that has little nodules on it that'll help you to stimulate circulation. It really does make a difference. And then don't forget, have plenty of water, because when you're on those long flights, you dehydrate so rapidly. And I don't know about you, but when I dehydrate, I get these awful headaches. They are just terrible. And some people like to take melatonin instead of prescription sleeping drugs, especially when they're on these long flights. Now, the sleeping drugs don't usually give you a restful deep sleep. So what Mr. Nyman recommends is 2.5 milligrams of melatonin a half hour before you take off. And that'll help your body go through an adjustment. Also, he said, you're going to be tempted to nap once you land, depending on the time difference, and staying active is important in helping the body to adjust to the new time zone. And you know what? It generally takes your body's biological clock approximately 1 day per time zone crossed to adjust. And also a little tip, eat lightly. It's better to have little munchies throughout your travel time than trying to eat, you know, 3 squares of food or stuffing yourself just because you have the opportunity. Let the body do its own job. And don't forget, if you're going to be really on a long flight, to take your vitamins and your other supplements and just try to keep to that routine because it really does help. And, you know, when we're talking about jet lag, you often have youngsters, they have a real hard time with going to sleep at night. And this could even happen when you're traveling with little ones. But kids, for some reason, seem to sleep tremendously well on planes. But they have discussed with so many different professionals how can parents work with kids at bedtime? And they say 78% of mothers have trouble getting their kids tucked into bed on time. And research has shown time and time again, and any mother will tell you, when your kid doesn't get enough sleep, they are just grumpy, grouchy, and just have an attitude. So sleep is so important. They say you want to maybe have dinner time about 2 hours before they go to bed. They say the reason is blood sugar levels dip a few hours after eating, causing the body to release an adrenaline-like hormone, making kids wired. Now, this comes from nutritionist Marcia Rice Hansford, who is a nurse. She said it won't disrupt bedtime since it's released when they're already asleep. And also, they find that children, if they're little feet are warm, even in warm weather, if they have on little socks, the kids seem to go to sleep better when their feet are covered. And I found that interesting because I've known lots of babies that are very happy sleeping without anything on their feet. And I can tell you this next one, though, is real. Dim the lights. It's with adults as well as with children. And you just need to know that the kids need to be able to shift into that zone. And one of the best ways is to have maybe a lower light on and then read them a story, a tucked in time when they're all cleaned up, they're in their jammies, and they're ready to listen to the story, and they have their favorite little cuddly toy with them, and they will just absolutely start to relax. And if you're going to feed them a snack before they go to bed, forget the milk and cookies. Let them have something else like some pumpkin seeds or maybe half of a peanut butter sandwich. And the reason that that's the case is tryptophan, an amino acid, helps to produce the sleep hormones serotonin and melatonin. Those are just a couple of little tips there for you. Bedtime battles? Oh, boy. Every parent in the world knows about that. So these are just some suggestions. So whether you're dealing with jet lag as an adult, kids seem to adjust much better than the adults do. And then, or you're dealing with bedtime situations with your children, there are always some options to consider. Now, I want to let you know about my guests that are going to be coming up next week. We're going to be talking with Dr. Steve Nugent, who is a nutritional expert, and we're going to be talking about information on how to be healthier in our lives and also about glyconutrients. And then we're going to be talking with Andrew Lopez about natural pest control. And then Marilyn Monroe, we're going to be talking about someone who believes that they have reincarnated as her. And then the doodle lady. We are going to find out how doodling can be so important in your life. And also, we're going to be talking with a mother and a daughter who had to deal with the shifts and changes in their life with a daughter going off to college. I'll Miss You Too is the name of their book. This is Donna Sebo. Chaos does not have to reign in life in a negative way. It can be a tipping point for a better life. Remember, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't ever forget that you're in charge of your world, and when you take care of your world, you're going to find that it ripples out and touches everybody else's. God bless. Have a fabulous, fabulous day. We'll talk with you on Monday. Bye for now.